Listening to the Career Musician Podcast with creator and host, Nomad. With 20-plus years of experience in the music industry, Nomad has done just about everything to earn a living as a career musician. From being music director to celebrity artists, playing iconic arenas and stadiums, composing for film and TV, and even playing your average local club gigs, he's done it all. Nomad's mission is to empower musicians across the globe with strategies for a sustainable career while blasting stereotypes, and to bring you tried and true wisdom from his colleagues in this crazy business we call music.
Today on the Career Musician Podcast, we celebrate our 100th episode by interviewing the host and creator of the career musician, Nomad. As the former music director for Kenny Babyface Edmonds, Donny Osmond, and more. As well, he's a coveted session player with credits like Barbra Streisand, Celine Dion, Toni Braxton, Justin Bieber, Aretha Franklin, Stevie Wonder, and Sting, just to name a few. You've heard Nomad's guitar playing featured on movie soundtracks like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Lilo and Stitch, Happy Feet 1 and 2, The Lorax, Ferdinand, People Like Us, and Men in Black 3. Nomad has countless placements with his two music production libraries, with credits in shows like Who Do You Think You Are, Fast Foodies, The Bradshaw Bunch, Hentified, and more. As a guitarist, composer, producer, and artist, Nomad has blasted the stereotype of musicians, proving that anyone can be a successful career musician. Now, without further ado, let's get to know more about the host and creator of the career musician, Nomad.
100 episodes slate.
All right. I like it. We're opening with a huge celebration, which was very unexpected, and I like it. Thanks. Way to lead it, Charlie. Now, you might be noticing there's something a little different about today's episode on the Career Musician Podcast. That's right. I am your host, lovely Lola. Joined with me is Eric G. I got Charlie in the back. And today we are interviewing the creator, the founder, the career musician himself, Nomad. Woo! Yeah. Man, our 100th episode. That is a reason to celebrate.
I agree. Wow. We made it. 100. You know, as my good buddy Joe Willis says, 100 of anything is a milestone. So here we are, 100.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're 100 after doing this podcast for so long?
I feel like I'm 700 after doing this podcast. But yes, that's quite a milestone, and I am grateful.
That's awesome. So as you know, maybe you don't know, we're married, so we'll just get that out of the way.
Yes.
So if there's some jokes, they might be had, or some poking, that's why.
The lovely Low.
Yeah, some formerly known or still known as Nomad and Lola.
That's right.
And now we got the rest of the career musician team here with us for the time ever. We have Eric G.
Eric G.
What's up?
Also known as the Lady of the Night.
Also known as the Smurf, or our son.
Or our son.
Oh my God, I have so many nicknames.
Or the barber, apparently.
Oh,
Barber / the bartender.
How about that?
I just cut Nomad's hair today.
Yeah, Charlie, you missed out on the early morning haircut.
And we also have.
And we got Charlie in the corner. Charlie in the corner. That's it.
C-Money. We called him C-Fred before, but C-Money, I think C-Money. That works. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it goes many ways, and I like it. So, you know, it is also New Year's Eve.
Yes.
So we might as well, you know,
Man.
Mention that as well. So happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody. Yeah.
And, you know, thank God we're getting over this year. I think we're all, we all struggled. And you know what? There's some bonding in that. There's some sense of like unity in knowing that we all kind of, you know, made it through something.
Made it through 2020.
Yeah.
The hellhole that it was.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it's also known, if we're going to be grateful about it, which we should, it's known as like the year of the pivot, right?
There you go.
So let me pivot right into this episode. Ooh, yeah. I like it. So when did you start the podcast? Back in 2015? But when did the real idea start?
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, you and I met back in 2009, I believe. And once we kind of started really getting into stride with not only our relationship, but then it seemed like our ideas of music and our business, you know, minds kind of linked up. I would say 2010, let's call it 2011. By 2011, we knew that we wanted to do something to speak to the musician community. It just wasn't fully formed yet. So for those next 3-4 years, we kept developing and you know, hammering away. By 2015, I did a tour with Babyface where we went to South Africa. And that's when I, you know, clearly remember interviewing some of the guys on that tour. And so that was 2015. So I like to say that officially the Career Musician Podcast started in 2015, even though we had, you know, a lot of preemptive ideas prior to that. And in that 2015, you know, impetus, I interviewed Bernie Boyle, who was the tour manager for us on that tour with Babyface and Tony Braxton. But he, ironically, was also the tour manager for Paul McCartney and the Beatles at some point, Michael Jackson, and literally the list of legends goes on. So, you know, I think he was like episode number 3 or 4, early episodes, single digits.
He's like number 4 or 5.
Something like that, yeah, single digits. And I was just enthralled that we were sitting at a really nice breakfast at the hotel. And I was just like, you know, hey, Bernie, tell me about your life. And boy, he, you know, he gave us some really amazing information. And I think that's what this is about. Capturing the stories, the insights, the knowledge, the wisdom from those who come before us and who have come before us. And really using that to inform the next generations of career musicians.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people have, you know, anybody who's listened to your podcast knows that, you know, you're well informed of music, you know, how did you get to be so well informed?
Well, well informed is kind of a vague term.
It is, but I didn't want to say, like, did you go to school for music?
Right,
like,
right.
How did you get your experience?
No, well, I did. I first of all, I went to a performing arts high school, Dillard High School of the Performing Arts in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And, you know, I'm very proud of that and grateful for that opportunity, where I had some amazing teachers. Daryl Kunisch, may he rest in peace, was one of my biggest mentors and amazing teachers. Jack Covell and Gary Goldman, in the same manner, really helped, you know, spawn the those beginning, the roots of what I would become later. And then from there, I had an opportunity, a scholarship to go to Berklee College of Music in Boston, but I bailed on it because I had an opportunity to go to Spain in a Beatles cover band, which I auditioned for and got the gig.
Now, which Beatle are you
going to
be?
Oh, I was going to be George Harrison, the guitar player, my favorite Beatle, the only Beatle. You know, I mean, as a guitar player, everybody knows George Harrison rules, you know. So I played the part of George. That's because you have a crush on him. But I played the part of George and we got the gig, and lo and behold, I didn't go to Spain. But then in turn, I got a scholarship to a local community college, Broward Community College, again in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And, you know, I went for a semester, crushed all my music classes, but failed miserably in everything else, you know, science, chemistry, English, algebra. And algebra was always my worst subject. So at that point, you know, I had the discussion with my folks and I was like, look, do I pursue this or do I go work? And my dad was always of the concept of, you know what, you don't need a piece of paper to tell you that you can play your instrument. So go get a gig, go work. Ironically enough, one of my buddies from the performing arts high school, Dillard, called me and said, hey, man, you want a gig? And Jason Beach, saxophone player, And yeah, I went and got a gig. I auditioned for that on the South Florida Strip, down on the beach. It was at a club called September's. Six nights a week, playing six sets a night. Jeez. We started at 9 p.m. We didn't end till 3 a.m. And I made $600 a week. So when you're 18, 19, making $600 a week, playing in a band, you kind of take on that whole, oh, well, I'm a rock star vibe, you know. And that was really the beginning of my career.
So you were 18, 19. How old was everybody else in the band?
At least, you know, 25 and up.
So you were the baby.
I was the baby. I couldn't even drink, you know.
Oh, what was that like?
It was an eye-opening experience. You know, thank God, you know, the drugs and the alcohol never really taunted me, so I didn't get into that scene. I was still hell-bent on going home every night, waking up the next day and practicing. So I was always concerned with practice, getting better, better, you know, working on my jazz chops, working on my classical chops, my flamenco chops, you know, and everything else in between. So I was so focused on that I didn't get really immersed in the nightlife. But all the other people were into the nightlife, but they all looked, you know, upon me in a very respectful manner. I think, you know, my dad, who was a very, he could be a sinister figure, 6'4", you know, a Cuban man, very very intimidating when he wanted to be. He would come down to the club every once in a while and make sure, hey, you treating my boy all right? You know, watch out. Don't let him get in any trouble, you know. So he was looking out for me. And, you know, thank God I had those figures in my life, like my father and everybody else who respected the process. And it was a great experience. I just really cut my teeth. I had that gig for 3 years. So I've learned so much about the music business and being a career musician in that.
Six nights a week.
Yeah. And Tuesday through Saturday.
I mean,
through Sunday, sorry.
That's right out of high school.
Right.
You know, which kind of is like a dream gig.
Yes.
In so many ways. And that's local still. And it's so nice to home. Although Spain would have been nice.
Spain would have been nice. I kind of chickened out. I should have went for the Spain gig now that I think about it in hindsight.
Well, you know. maybe it just wasn't meant to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, it started much earlier, though, than
right.
18 for you.
Right.
You know, you kind of were an entrepreneur when it came to your bands, and you were always, you know, kind of the leader, the MD. Can you talk about, you know, getting started? Like, what got you started?
I'm glad you said the E word. My dad and mom were always entrepreneurs. They always had their own businesses, whether it was in the cosmetology fashion, or my dad was a tile contractor, which I used to work with him in the summers. My dad was a musician as well. And that gene just kind of, you know, lived through the family, you know, tradition. And when I was 12, I got, you know, I think I was 10, I got my first guitar. I took a couple lessons and they were teaching me Mary Had a Little Lamb. So I was just not interested. But when I was 12, I was born and raised in New York, Long Island, New York. Strong Island, baby. You got to give it up to my East Coast. You know, when I saw Eddie Van Halen, I think I was 12, 1984. I saw him on MTV. And the video for Jump came on. I saw David Lee Roth, Eddie Van Halen, Michael Anthony, Alex Van Halen. I was just enamored. I was like, Dad, that's what I want to do. So I went and grabbed that guitar that I threw under the bed and pulled it out. And, he, you know, my dad was really cool. He got me a nice little Fender Strat, you know, a student model and a little amp. And I said, Dad, I just really want to pursue this. And he's like, all right, let's go. We went to the guitar store, Focus 2 Guitars on Long Island, in Comac, Long Island. And he got me a distortion pedal. So that way I can play all the sounds, you know, that Eddie was getting. And man, from there, we just never looked back. So he made sure he would take me to Focus 2 Guitar Center every week to get my lessons. And then just studying Van Halen. And it just really, I really took to it. At that point, that's when he was like, you know, again, my name is Michael, as we all know. You know, hey, Mike, come on out and show off some of your Van Halen licks, you know, every time he's hanging out with his buddies. So that's when the bug really bit me. And then I knew I just wanted to do that. But that was 12. And then I got some really great teachers privately who exposed me to some great music. You know, Wes Montgomery, Al Di Meola, Niccolo Paganini, the violinist, the composer. You know, all these different things, classical, jazz, fusion, rock, and all these different things. And I was like, okay, I'm in this for the long haul. Right around I was 14, 15, that's when my folks said, oh, we're moving to Florida. I was crushed. And that, but, you know, in turn, it worked out because I went to that performing arts high school. But so while I was in New York, I had my own rock band called Malachi. And yes, I was the band leader. I was the MD for that, the music director. And my buddies, I love them. God rest his soul, Adam Dunn, the drummer, you know, who's since left. But he was amazing. And Mike Filippi, the guitar player, I would teach him on guitar. And then he was the second guitar player. And my dear friend, best friend for life, Greg Tellison, was playing bass. We never had a lead singer, but we would all write lyrics and melody. But we never had a lead singer to pull it off. So we were always, my dad was so cool. He was like, yeah, just go in the basement and knock it out. So we would just be pounding away in the basement for hours. My poor parents and brothers would just have to listen to this, you know, insane rock cacophony coming from beneath them.
That's awesome.
That's how it started.
What an awesome, you know, what an awesome story to be able to tell.
Right.
You got to rock away at 13 in the basement, you know. Well, for me, I'm a California girl, so I don't know what a basement is.
Right?
But I imagine it's like a garage.
Yeah, it's underneath the house, but it's very garage-esque.
No, I get it. But that's really funny that you always took a leadership role when it comes to music, you know?
Yeah.
When did you know that music was what you wanted to do for a living? Like, was there a moment?
Yeah, good point. So right after that, right after we left New York and I realized, oh, wow, you know, I have to leave my friends. This sucks. But I knew I was a good leadership role kind of person because of my strong type A personality. I always had to be in control, you know. Once I got to Florida and enrolled in the school and realized, wow, you know what? I can make a career out of this. And through my teachers, those various teachers that I mentioned, their encouragement. I knew that I wanted to do it as a career. And then I started reading all the magazines, the industry magazines about all the session cats in LA. So Paul Jackson Jr., Nathan East, Greg Fillinganes, Vinnie Caliuta, you know, the list goes on, Steve Lukather. I said, okay, that's it. I want to be a studio guy. So I knew I wanted to be a studio guy. I was always very shy through all of my elementary years, your fundamental school years, and even through high school. I was always very shy. I didn't have girlfriends, as you would think. So I was introverted. So I figured, you know what? The studio is perfect because I don't have to be on stage. I don't have to dance. I don't have to showboat. I don't have to be this flashy person. I can just be in the studio, cut the records, you know, make a good paycheck and be content. So that was my goal. By the time I was 15, I knew I wanted to be a session cat, as we call it.
I mean, like, no offense, but it's not like, you know, they had Instagram and Facebook and ways for you to discover about the hidden talents like a session musician. So how did you even know about session musicians?
Like I said, all the publications I was, you know, subscribing to Mix Magazine, to Guitar Player Magazine, to, you know, Sound on Sound, whatever publications I can get my hand on, I was reading those and you know, just studying up on it.
It's amazing because you think how easy kids have it now.
You do. It's amazing because you can pick up your phone and just scroll through and just be like, wow, the whole world is at your fingertips, literally.
How often do we go, who's that? You know, we Shazam it.
Right.
Or we, you know, look up who the composer is for a film.
That's right.
Yeah. So speaking of, you know, being a composer for film or, you know, touring for somebody or being in the session, you know, can you talk about the path that you took to become the career musician that you are? You know, talk about like the evolution.
It's funny because we were just talking about this with Eric and Charlie and yourself at our little lunch break earlier. You know, and we always say, had I known then what I know that now, and that is so true.
Exactly.
Understatement of lifetime, and I think we can all drink to that, you know.
Oh, so, yeah.
Salud, right?
How's everybody's drinks tonight?
Yeah, good.
All right.
Not bad. Eric, by the way, Eric G makes the best old fashioned, so yeah, that's what we're sipping on. This is truly a celebration. All right. Well, I never forget, at Dillard High School of Performing Arts, we had several ensembles, and one was called, we had jazz ensemble, of course, and then rock ensemble, which was called rock band, really. And with rock band and jazz ensemble, we would go out and do gigs in the local community. We would play at the library, we would play at the local parks, we'd play for middle schools, whatever. And I remember specifically packing up from one event that we played, an outdoor event, and one of the teachers said, you see that guy right there? And he was pointing to me as I was loading the truck, wrapping cables and throwing in gear, amps and stuff. He goes, that guy's going to make it in the business. You know why? Because he's got hustle. He's always working hard. He's always the first one here and the last one to leave. And I don't even remember that teacher's name, but I just was so grateful that he said that. I was like, wow, thank you, Mr. So-and-so. You know, I really appreciated that. And I took that to heart. And from then on, I was just like, that's it. No matter what it takes, I'm going to make it. So after I graduated high school and I had that super dope gig, then I lost that gig. And when I lost that gig, that's when the rubber really met the road, because I was like, okay, now what am I going to do? Well, I hustled. I went out and got a bunch of other gigs. I just started going to all the jam sessions, hanging out at the clubs, and I started studying with the local cats who I looked up to. So I would go find the guitar player that I thought was amazing and say, Randy Burnson was one in the South Florida area. And I said, Randy, can I study with you? And this was on the cusp of me still trying to figure out how to master bebop, jazz, and still trying to figure out how to make a living. And Randy is a bebop master. And again, Charlie and I and Eric were talking about this earlier. And Randy said, you know, fuck bebop, man. That doesn't mean you're not going to make any money. But not only that, do what's in your soul. And when I would play the blues, Randy would be like, dude, when you play the blues, you come alive. Like, that's their language. So then I started to figure out, okay, well, if I can do that. So I found my own way. I started melding my own little identity, my own little genre identity. And then I knew once I got a couple gigs and I would play with a pop band, a funk band, and this, and I was like, okay, I can do this. And that's when it really became legit. When I didn't have that gig any longer, because that one house residency gig, that made it easy.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a residency gig and you literally got to hustle every night, $100 here, $50 here, $75 here. Oh, I got a wedding, $250 here. Yay. You know, that's really that's the test.
Yeah. Well, and then as a musician, having those little bits of, you know, you call it like, what do they call it? There's a term for it. It's like something with a squirrel where they're putting away the nuts for winter.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. You gotta store up your nuts for the winter because, you know, if not, you're going to starve, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
So you started out in, you know, just local garage bands, basement bands.
Right.
You know, playing for local gigs, making, you know, $100 here, whatever. Then you got an awesome residency gig, you know, the dream gig, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
From there, where do you go? Like, I mean, I know now you're gigging around with the other places, but you know, that kind of grows stagnant for a while, right? Or where do you go from there?
You're absolutely right. It does grow stagnant. And when I lost that gig at September's, that residency gig, I saw an ad in one of the flyers, local, you know, Penny Saver or whatever. Which, wow, we don't have those anymore. Shut up. Anyway, it was like funk, 70s funk band looking for a guitar player. So I was like, oh, that's me, man. I can play. You know, and at that time I was all into the Ohio Players, you know, P-Funk, Earth, Wind & Fire, Stevie Wonder, all this stuff. So I was like, okay, I could do this. So I went and did the audition. And of course, you know, I show up with my big rig. I had the, you know, half stack and a head, Marshall head, and a bunch of pedals, long hair down to here. And, you know, here comes this white dude with this guitar, rock guitar vibe. And it's a bunch of brothers, you know, and they're like, yeah, we're a funk band. They look at me, they're like, you're not going to fit this band. I'm like, no, let me just play. And then I started playing. They're like, okay, you're good. Because I can play all the funk rhythms, but then I can play the rock solos, you know. So that was a lot of fun. And that was Magic City. They called themselves the Magic City Funk Factory. And to this day, one of my best friends, his name is Kevin Jonas. He's the drummer in that band and co-founder. And we're still best friends to this day. And man, he was like, he would be like, Rapal, when you came in that band and you tore that shit up, man, I knew you was a motherfucker, man. And that's it. This was your gig, man. And that was it. Like, and when you get that kind of acceptance, and I think that's my point. When you put yourself in situations to be discovered, or you have to put yourself out there, it's very nerve-wracking. But when you do get that validation, as soon as you get that first piece of validation, that's it. You're done. Signed, sealed, delivered. I'm in. And when he would make a comment like that, or, you know, he took me under his wing as his little brother, that's it. It's done. It signs the deal. You know, you're in. I'm a career musician. Of course, back then I didn't coin the term. I didn't know what it meant, but I was a lifer, as we say.
But now you've shifted your gears. You don't want to be a session musician anymore because you didn't really do that. You're doing band stuff, right?
Well, hold on. The thing is, I always wanted to be a session musician, but in Miami, there wasn't really a big session scene in Fort Lauderdale, Miami, South Florida. So I was playing wherever I could play. But then during the day when I would, you know, come home late at night and then wake up and practice, I also had my little workstation, my little early stages of a DAW, digital audio workstation, where I had a Korg T3 and an Alesis MMT8 sequencer.
Next to the Atari.
Do you still have those?
Yeah, next to the Atari. I still don't have that. I don't have those anymore. Yeah.
That might be fun to mess with those.
But yes, I can't believe you bastards. I did have an Atari and a Nintendo. I had all that. Okay. And a cassette player. I even had an 8-track at one point. But and of course vinyl, you know. I was always in my room, which was my studio, just mixing shit up and see what I can come up with. So I was doing both at the same time.
So from there, so are you touring with these guys or is this just local?
No, local dates. So we would go out on South Beach, you know, the famed South Beach in South Florida, and we would do like the Clevelander. The Clevelander is a famous venue down in South Beach. We would play there, and we were like a 10-piece funk band with live horns and everything. I think I would probably make about $1, maybe $1.25. And then, you know,
a night.
And then we'd be out there all night and I wouldn't get home till 3 or 4 in the morning. We would do that once a week. Then we would do a gig at Mango's on Fort Lauderdale Beach in the Las Olas district. And which led me, eventually I met my dear friend, Jesse Campo, who was a Cubana Chilean singer in the same area. And we just kind of hit it off. Oh, that's right, because she was in the September's band. That's how we met, in the residency band. And her and I just hit it off, and we stayed in touch. And she goes, you know what? She used to call, she calls me, she still does, she calls me Mikey. I'm like, it's
only
Nomad. Yeah, I know. Anyway, she's like, so Mikey, you should do like this flamenco thing, and we could get you gigs. Anyway, because I always loved flamenco. Like Paco de Lucia is my... the legend of all legends. I love that man. You know, since then he's passed, and but he's the godfather of flamenco guitar. And she said, you know, and I always dabbled in flamenco. I can't play it for real. I do my own hybrid version of it. She said, if you put together a little hybrid flamenco demo tape, I can take you and I can book you. So she did. So she started booking me, and I started getting gigs in Miami Beach playing flamenco at all these little cafes and you know, bars and stuff. And then again, once again, reinventing. So I go from residency pop band gig to funk band gig.
Well, it almost was a Beatles impersonation.
Yeah, and Beatles, yeah. Right, exactly. Tribute. And then to this flamenco solo act. So I started sequencing. We used to call it sequencing back then. Sequencing all of my backing tracks, where I was playing like Gypsy Kings and Strunz and Farrar and Paco de Lucia and Upmar Farrar, that's right, and Upmar Liebert and all these, you know, hybrid flamenco guys, and I would make my own tracks, and then I wrote my own album. And then Jesse introduced me to this guy, Gordy, Rogelio Gonzalez, who called himself Gordy. He had Gordy Recording Studios. Now, enter 1994, 5, 6. Now I became the session guy that I always knew I was, because Gordy had a dope studio in Miami. I would go there every night. We would be in the studio. And Gordy was a night guy. He didn't like to... We would start working at 9 p.m. and not leave the studio until 8 a.m. And then he would treat me to breakfast. I'd drive home, go to sleep, wake up the next day, do it all over again.
You mean later than night?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's, so now I'm gigging on certain, on the weekends mostly. And then, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday in the studio all night with Gordy. And that's when I recorded my first album called Esperando, which is a hybrid flamenco album mixed with some Cuban elements. Now, Gordy was Cuban-Mexican. I'm Cuban-Italian. His wife at the time was Cuban, Blanquita, just a white girl who was half Cuban. And then Jesse would come in, and she's Cuban and Chilean. And we had all these Puerto Rican friends and Dominican friends. So we're partying all night in the studio, but really not partying because, again, I wasn't into the party scene. I was so focused on the music. So I was writing horn arrangements. I was playing guitar. I was co-producing with Gordy, and that's when my first album came out. And I just knew that I had to be in the studio. So I was living the dual life. I was in the studio and doing dates. Yeah, you know, as we call them, dates, gigs.
So you're about what, 24, 25?
Yeah, mid early 20s. Yeah, exactly.
What point did you make the move to Nashville?
When I realized that, okay, I had reached the ceiling there. I had done a lot of studio work, and I said, you know what? I got to go to Nashville to really become the session ace that I want to be. So it was 1997 when I moved to Nashville. And for the first year, I worked at a bagel shop. Couldn't get a gig, couldn't get a session. You know, I was really careful. My dad would never let me use power tools growing up because he didn't want me to hurt my hands. In the bagel shop, we had these giant bread knives. And I would never hold it like that, but then we had these bagel holders. You slide the bagel in, and the knife would go like this. So your hand was never in the way. So I was really careful not to cut my hands. I would go in. I would wake up at 4 a.m., be at the bagel shop by 4:35, and work till about 1, lunchtime. Go home, practice, or work on tracks. And then that night, go out to the local Nashville scene and try to network and connect, and then do it all over again. Sure enough, just less than a year in, I got the gig with Kirk Whalum, famed gospel, jazz, R&B saxophonist extraordinaire. And I was doing weekend warrior dates with him, fly dates. So we would leave on a Thursday or Friday, come home on a Sunday, Monday. And then I'd go back to the bagel shop. I mean, I was grinding. It was never like, oh man, I had arrived and this was the life. It was always like grind.
Well, that's what it is, right? Yeah. That's the secret behind the music business.
Grit, baby, if you don't have that.
Most people don't realize.
Yeah.
Were they good bagels?
Bro, I'm a New Yorker. The bagels were amazing. I can make a really good bagel.
I have yet to taste this bagel. that's such foresight.
No, but it's a varied, you know, a combination of things to make it all work. And, you know, it does take that grit. So
now you're you know, cruising up and down Music Row in Nashville.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're there for a year. You're not getting much success. You're on your own. Like, I mean, there's no family there with you.
No.
Like, you know, it's not like you got any...
reach out to mom and dad or siblings,
right?
Or
no support net, yeah. You know, or safety net. So what are you doing? Like, how did you break through? What happened?
Hustling. So literally, I mean that in every, you know, literal sense that, like I said, working at the bagel shop to make sure I had the bills covered, doing some tour dates, fly dates with Kirk, and then just connecting in the scene. Sure enough, it wasn't long before I can quit the bagel gig because I was in the studio now. So I was there in Nashville for 8 years. 7 of those years, I was in the studio 24/7. So I had worked with, a lot of gospel groups and contemporary Christian groups, as well as a lot of pop and R&B groups. You know, everybody from, I did the Prince of Egypt soundtrack with the Caldwell brothers there. Yeah. I played with Natalie Grant.
No, I watched it in the theater.
Oh my God. Okay, David. I always joke that these two are Alexis and David from Schitt's Creek, so it's kind of funny. I love when you do that. Okay, all right. So, Prince of Egypt soundtrack to, you know, Yolanda Adams, gospel, great, I mean, amazing singer. Natalie Grant, CCM, CC Winans, and BB Winans, gospel legends, you know. I played Amy Grant. you know, I had done so many sessions, Toby Mack from DC Talk and all these people. So I was in the studio. So here's the key. And I want every career musician, and I'm looking at the camera on purpose. I want every career musician watching this to pay attention to this. Hopefully you made it through all the bullshit up to this point. Listen, when you find your niche, that's the gold mine. Keep this in mind. I moved to Nashville to pursue my career as a studio musician only to play Latin, R&B, and gospel music. What does that tell you? Think about that. I moved to Nashville, country music capital of the world, to pursue a career as a session guitarist in Latin, gospel, and R&B music. So I figured out those were some of the skill sets that I was really good at. I can play rock. I can play jazz. I could certainly play country. Matter of fact, I practiced a lot of country before moving there. But I found a niche because it was like, you know what? There's so many great country players here. There's so many great rock players. There's not a lot of people doing Latin, you know, jazz, R&B, gospel. And I carved out this little path. And through that, I was able to, you know, I built a catalog. You know, not only was I playing on records and receiving, you know, residuals from playing on those records, but I was writing a lot of the songs in those genres. And I was building a little catalog for myself. You know, I wrote a hit with Toby Mack, formerly of DC Talk, you know, Lose My Soul. I Don't Want to Lose My Soul. And it was Toby Mack and Kirk Franklin. And I'm a partial writer on that track. So to this day, I receive royalties from that. My point is not bragging. My point is that you can do it. You can do it. If you stay focused, keep your head down, focus on your work. Don't listen to all the bullshit out here. Disregard the social media, this and all this other stuff. Stay focused. You can do it. Sorry, I didn't mean to get so preachy on that.
I love it. That's the whole point. Like, I mean, you are the career musician. Like, this is, it embodies you. This is your heart. You breathe, you sleep it, you eat, breathe, and
sleep it. Yeah, that's everything. It. The whole concept,
you
know. Yeah.
You bleed blue. But, you know, is that why you started the podcast? Or I should ask, why?
Partially.
Did you start?
Yes, partially, because I had always felt there's two things that I felt in my career as a musician, fulfillment and disdain. So fulfillment because, wow, my resume is pretty good. I've played on a lot of films. My filmography is great. My discography is great. My performance resume is great. But I also felt disdain because although I was performing and working for all of these celebrities, I never had true fulfillment because I was never doing my own thing. So that disdain becomes this bitterness. And it's not a disdain for any one person in particular. It becomes like this disdain for the industry as a whole. The industry is really difficult.
It's jaded.
You can get extremely jaded. And then you can get put under the thumb by the industry as a whole. And then you think, oh man, it's this very defeatist kind of mentality. I said, no, I'm sorry. I can't get with that. So I had to flip it and reframe it, you know. And for those of us who don't know, like Lola mentioned, we are married. And you, as you know, have been very instrumental in helping me reframe my successes and reframe my accolades as a whole and be like, you know what? No. These are victories, and you just have to, this is how you think about it. So that was the impetus for saying, you know what, if I'm feeling this, I bet you there's a lot of other professional musicians who feel this. Let me go out and interview all my colleagues, peers, and people who I look up to, and find out from them firsthand what they think. And I think by that whole process, that's when you really learn, oh, wow. Okay, I'm not special. This is nothing new. A lot of other people feel this.
Yeah.
And once you have that kind of, again, that's a validation. Mm-hmm. That other people.
I'm not alone.
Exactly. Then it brings about a whole new wave of positive emotions.
Well, you know, I kind of started jumping the gun here. You know, you're in Nashville. You start getting on some really great records. You start making some really great endorsement deals. You start making a name for yourself in a particular niche, you know, why would you leave that and then move out to LA?
It's funny you asked that. I had two beautiful houses in Franklin, Tennessee.
What?
Yes. Two beautiful houses. And I was renting one out, and I was living in the other. And I said, you know, the Goatee brothers, there was this guy named Mike McLaughlin who said, you know, you'd do great in film. And I said, yeah, I know. Please don't remind me. You know, and of course I was being
my childhood dream.
Yeah, exactly. I was being facetious, you know. And he's like, no, you should go to LA. I'm like, but Mike, you know, I've developed quite a career here. He's like, man, you could do it. If anybody could do it, I believe in you, man. You should try it. And once he planted that seed, I was like, oh shit, I know I gotta do this because I had always felt it. So I came out west to pursue, you know. And look, when I came out here, I kind of have a storybook, you know, trajectory of how this all played out.
Do you know anybody coming out?
Well, here's the thing. Because I was on tour with Kirk Whalum doing those fly dates, those weekend fly dates, I had been hobnobbing with a bunch of L.A. cats. So the whole time I'm collecting everybody's email and phone number. So I'm staying in touch. And I made good pals with a guy named Dave Hooper, a drummer, a great drummer out here in L.A. He's played with everybody. And we stayed in contact. And I said, Dave, I'm thinking about moving to L.A. And he goes, oh, great. If you come, you should check out Valencia. It's in Santa Clarita. It's a nice little area. I live there. I think you'll dig it because you have the little family vibe going on. And it's a very family-oriented town. And literally 3 months later, I was like, hey, Dave, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, man, I'm just chilling. I said, well, why don't we meet for coffee? He's like, but I thought you were in Nashville. I said, no, I moved to Valencia. He barely, you know, he basically dropped the phone. He's like, what? You moved to? I said, yeah, let's meet for coffee. I'll be there in 10 minutes. You know, and then I met him. He's like, oh my, and this is what he said to me. I can't believe you actually moved here and you did it. Like so many people talk shit and never do it, but you did it. Okay, right from that when the time that happened, every morning at 8 a.m. sharp, I was down at the local coffee shop with my old fashioned laptop that weighed like 37 pounds, you know, because it's 2005, you know, I'm cracking that sucker open. I had a Palm Pilot phone. You remember those guys? Yeah. And this is pre-iPhone. So you know what I did? I called up all my homies that I met when I was on the road with Kirk, all the homies that lived in LA. So I called Alex Al, bass player for Michael Jackson and everybody else, you know, Dave Hooper, Dave Kochansky, who at that time was the MD for the American Idols live tour. Wayne Lindsay, famous keyboard player. Paul Jackson Jr. You know, I called everybody who I ever came in contact with. And I just said, hey, you know, I just want to let you know I'm in L.A. You know, I'm so glad to be here. If you ever need anything, please let me know. I'd be happy to do whatever I can to help you in whichever way possible. And, you know, when you put yourself out there like that, humbly, and you're not a dick about it, and you don't come off like, man, I'm the baddest motherfucker around. You don't come off egotistical, and you just come off like, hey, man, I'm just here. People respond to that actually really well. Sure enough, Dave Kochansky said, I'm doing the American Idols live tour. You don't even have to audition. The gig is yours if you want it.
What? Talk about networking.
So he goes, you're in Valencia. Come down to Sherman Oaks to my studio. I'll give you the whole book, the book of songs. And back then, we were still doing CDs, and it was still books and, you know, not PDFs, but actual books of
which
charts.
Tour
and
was this?
The American Idols live tour 2005, Carrie Underwood year.
Oh.
Okay, she won. So I was stoked. We hung out with him for the studio for 3-4 hours. We went and had food. He's like, yeah, go home, learn the book. You know, rehearsals start in a week. I'll see you at Center Staging. Now, if you don't know, Center Staging is the premier rehearsal studio in L.A. We'll get to that in a minute. Don't forget.
Oh. Lola
used to run the offices there. And he said, yeah, we'll start the tour. Man, a week later, I was in the tour rehearsals, and Ricky Minor was there because he was the executive producer of the show for the band. And we were rehearsing for like 2 or 3 weeks at Center Staging. Then we moved down to Florida to do full-blown production rehearsals in one of the arenas down there. And then we toured for, I think it was like 3 or 4 months. That was probably 3 months after I landed in L.A. Before that, before I went on that tour, Alex Al, the bass player from Michael Jackson and you name it, referred me to a session for a film composer named John Powell. Now, if you don't know who John Powell is, he is the composer who did everything. Like right now, he's most notably known for the How to Train Your Dragon franchise. But he did Shrek. He did the Bourne Identity, Jason Bourne series. And with him, based on Alex Al's referral, my first session with him was Mr. and Mrs. Smith with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. Then it was Happy Feet 1. Then it was Happy Feet 2. Then it was Kung Fu Panda. Then it was P.S. I Love You. Then it was The Lorax. Then it was, and it just kept going. And then the last film I did with him was Ferdinand. In the interim, he referred me to Danny Elfman to do Men in Black 3. So, again,
The names that you're dropping are huge.
But you have to remember.
Did you drop this name right now?
And listen. This isn't for a braggadocious manner because, a lot of those guys, I don't work with them anymore. They just don't call me on a consistent enough basis. But I will say this. Again, put yourself out there, be humble, and say, how can I be of assistance to you?
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Now, the reason why Alex Al referred me to the session with John Powell is because Alex was on a session with John on Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and Alex was playing bass. Now, again, Alex is, a value added. He can play upright bass. He can play funk, electric bass. He can play jazz bass. Any slap bass, any kind of bass you want, Alex is going to play it. Not only that, can he play it? He can read it. So he's on a session at John's studio in Pacific Palisades, and he says, "Hey, man, I need a guitar player," and this is exactly how Alex told me, "I need a guitar player that can play funk, flamenco, country, and rock." And Alex goes, "Oh, man, it's so ironic you asked me that. My buddy just moved from Nashville, and he can play all that." He goes, "Great, give me his number." That's it.
And that's how it always is, though, right? For everything in this business.
You know what? I preach that you should have all of your marketing tools together. You should have your branding together. You should have your soliciting game down. But you know what? It usually never comes from a blind solicitation. It usually always comes from an inside connection. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You should still have all that other stuff together, just in case.
You gotta have your shit together.
Yeah.
But it is also about networking and being known for something.
Right. There you go. Being known for something. And when people say flamenco and funk, they usually don't think those two. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's not a common request.
I feel like you as a musician who's trained, who really knows when you hear like authentic flamenco,
right,
and authentic funk, authentic funk. And you bring that pressure on yourself, like, do I really need to be that authentic? And usually when they ask for that, that's not what they mean.
They don't even mean, right. They kind of, it's like
you're putting more pressure on yourself to see if you can fill those gaps.
That's right.
Yeah. But really, like, you just walk in and go, chicka-ding.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, yes.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
That's right.
Paco.
That's right. Because right. You're so right. Because when I think flamenco, I think, play a triad with a flat 9. omitting the seventh. And, you know, and right, exactly. And most people don't understand. I love how David and Alexis.
It just comes out, right?
And when I think funk, I think, you know, minor six chord to a minor seven, you know what I mean? With a dominant tritone, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, like, as soon as I...
yeah. You're, like, squeaking so much.
I know, I'm sorry.
Would you stop squeaking? Damn it, it's too late now. We're all three right. quarters of the way through.
All right.
Stop moving.
Okay, let's bring it back around. So, wow. I mean, it's quite a story. Like, you've really evolved, and you've really,
amen. Thank you know, I'm grateful.
Grown. And then somehow, some way, somewhere in there, you end up being the music director for Babyface for 10 years.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, somewhere. How did that, you know, come about? So you went on the tour for American Idol, and then where do you go?
So it's so funny. I'm glad you brought that up. At the time, I went through a really rough divorce, and, you know, again, for those who are going through divorce or who might experience that, there is hope. There is light at the end of the tunnel. My point is, my daughter was in Nashville with her mom, and I was living in California. But because they went back to Nashville, I was going back. I was commuting. Every 2 weeks, I would go to Nashville and stay for a week. And to the point where I got an apartment in Nashville and a little beater car, a little shitty car, and a little funky apartment in somebody's basement. And then I would live in LA primarily, but then every 2 weeks I'd go back to Nashville for a week. As I'm in Nashville, a buddy of mine calls me, Ray Islas, percussionist, who now is the percussionist for Chicago. But at the time he was the percussionist for Christina Aguilera. He goes, "Hey man, I referred you to the MD for Christina Aguilera. They're doing auditions. I think you would crush it." I said, "Wow, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that." He said, "The MD was going to call you probably in a day or so." I said, "Great." His name is Rob Lewis. I was stoked. Okay, I'm in Nashville visiting my daughter. But I had my 818 number and I had my LA address, and I was going to fly back to LA in a couple days anyway. And I said, "Great." Anyway, Rob calls me, Rob Lewis, who was the MD for, at the time, Christina and Babyface and Tony Braxton and a bunch of other people. And he says, "Yeah, man, you know, we're doing the Christina auditions on this date. But prior to that, I need somebody for Babyface. Do you want to audition for that as well?" I was like, "Absolutely." So he goes, "All right, the audition is tomorrow at 7 o'clock. This was a Monday night, and I'm driving my car in Nashville. And so the audition is Tuesday at 7 p.m. in L.A. So as soon as I hung up with him, I got on southwest.com. I'm like, "Oh, shit, Southwest, get me back to L.A. I fly back to L.A., and I get off the plane at, like, freaking 6 o'clock, drive right from LAX to the studio in Hollywood, walk in sick as a dog. I caught a bug on the plane with my acoustic guitar. There's like six or seven other guitar players there. I walk into his posh multi-million-dollar facility, Babyface's studio, and I'm blown away. But I'm like, the first thing I do is cover myself up and say, "Guys, I'm so sorry. I got really sick on the plane right over here. Would you mind if I just kind of go first so that I can get in and get out and go home and take some NyQuil?"
And that was pre-COVID, by
that
the
was pre-COVID,
way.
Yeah.
Genius.
And this was 2007, mind you, 2007. And all the guys were like, "Yeah, of course, man. If you don't feel good, yeah, go for it. So I go in and I say hi to Babyface sitting there, and Rob Lewis sitting there, and the engineer, Paul Bootson, sitting there. I say, "Hi, guys. I'm so, so grateful to meet you. I don't want to shake your hands because I'm feeling under the weather. I really want to just play for you. I'm so excited to do this. Thank you. And then I'll just kind of get out of your hair." And they were like, "Okay, cool, man." I sit down and they're like, "Well, tell me about yourself." I'm like, "Well, I did this." I explained all the Nashville stuff, and I played with Kirk, and I played with Jonathan Butler, and this and that. And then they're like, "Okay, we'll play Change the World." So we play Change the World, and they say, "Yeah, take a solo." And as I take a solo, I start scatting because George Benson is one of my favorite, you know, guitar heroes. Okay. So, you know, so as I'm playing, like, you know, right? You know, you're playing a groove, you know, and then like, "Take a solo." So I'm like, you know, so then all of a sudden they're like, "Oh, you're scatting." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't help it. George is such a huge influence, you know." So So they're like, no, it's cool, it's cool, it's cool. So I played that song. And they're like, all right, well, why don't you go ahead and play the next song? You know, Face had just recorded an album of acoustic covers. So why don't you play the next one? It was a James Taylor song. Fire and Rain, you know, and just yesterday morning, you know, so I'm like, okay, so I did that, and I think I did one or two other songs. I'm in my element, sick as a dog or not, I'm in my element. I know this shit inside and out. Played, I think, four songs, and they were cool, and they gave me some props, and they were like, you know what, cool, man, we'll be in touch, thank you so much, but they were very positive, so I felt good, sick as a dog, go home, NyQuil it up, sleep it off. 2 days later, Rob calls, hey, man, I think we're going to do some callbacks. Absolutely. I'm feeling better by this point. Mind you, at this point, I was the music director for Donny Osmond.
Oh, so, just forgot that. Donny Osmond was in there, and you were his music director.
Yes, I forgot about that. Okay. I met Donny Osmond somewhere along the way, and became his music director, and it was a short-lived stint. And but anyway,
yeah, because Babyface came calling.
Well, basically, that's what happened. And even Babyface's manager was like, so we know you're with Donnie, and we respect that, and we love Donnie. Of course, he's a legend, you know. But you know, so is Kenny, and he's kind of a legend too. And we really love to have you. And then I got the gig as the guitar player. So I did the gig with Babyface for 2 years as the guitar player, and then you know. One thing led to another, and the MD position opened up, and I became the music director. So I held that position for 10 years. And, you know, it's not a position I took lightly. I took it very seriously, as I do all my positions. And it was great. I learned so much, just like I learned working with Donnie, just like I learned working with Kenny, just like I learned working for anybody from
Malachi
in my basement in New York. Exactly. You know, I took every job. My parents always called me Felix Unger. So back in the, it was the Odd Couple back in the day, there was a show called The Odd Couple. And I was always Felix Unger, who was the real square one, who was really clean and neat and, you know, OCD type. I was Felix. So I was always very serious and just, you know, I always feel uncomfortable if things aren't just right. I have to have order.
So that worked out for you. Yeah. But it does come very well in handy, though, because if you're not organized, if you don't have your shit together, if you don't have your metadata in order, guess what? There's money on the table, and you're putting it right there, and nobody's going to catch it. So, you know, we've talked about the evolution of Nomad and you becoming the career musician. Starting the podcast because you felt like you've seen so many musicians be taken advantage of, and there's so many sad and amazing stories out there. Like, there's good and there's bad, you know, and if you can learn from the lessons of some amazing people who've already done it, well, then that's only a bonus for you.
Right.
So out of all of these 100 episodes, because this is the 100th episode. So exciting.
Hell yeah.
It is.
Out of 100 episodes.
Cheers.
I'm all out.
Oh, okay. Well,
I need a refill.
I have a sip left.
Out of 100 episodes, is there, I'm sure there's many lessons that have stood out, but is there maybe one or two that really, like, in your mind, you learned something?
Shut up and listen. I always say, I started saying this a long time ago, eyes and ears wide open, mouth shut. When I found myself going to Sony or Warner Brothers or NBC or, you know, any of these big studios out here in LA, and you see all these hundreds of people running around and doing their jobs, wow, there's so much to this that I just don't know. So instead of walking around showboating, acting like you know everything with your swag and your this and that, I'd be like, no, there's a lot to be learned. I better just shut up and watch and listen and learn. And as I interview people, I've gotten better at interviewing because my first interviews, I was always trying to talk along with them and talk over them. And And I cringe at the thought of that, you know. And now I just try to listen more because there's so much to learn. You know, I'm 48. I'm on the cusp of 50. And I still feel like an infant when it comes to knowledge gained. Like there's so much I can learn. And that's the underlying thread. You just don't know. And sometimes I'm guilty of it with you, Lola. You know, you'll be telling me something and I'll think I can preemptively guess what you're going to say. And you're like, actually, that's not what I was going to say. And I'm like, okay, sorry. So then I'll just listen, you know. And I think that's a great example. From that example all the way through hanging out with John Powell or David Foster or Randy Jackson or Babyface or, you know, even the time I met Eddie Van Halen or this is my hero, you know. Just shut up and listen. If you don't have anything to say, don't say it. You know, what's that old, you know, proverb? It's better to keep your mouth closed and let everybody assume that you're a fool than open it and remove all doubt. Mm. You know?
Right.
So, yeah,
I know we didn't really talk about it here at all, but I personally know that you've always been a fan of people like Tony Robbins and other really, you know, some motivational speakers and things like that. So, you know, when did you discover that you had that gift in you as well as talent, you know, being able to speak to the masses and inspire and motivate them?
Thank you for asking that. It means a lot. That same time when I was in my room in South Florida practicing during the day and doing the gigs at night, I had handwritten posters on the wall, you know, mind, body, spirit, soul. You know, if you can dream it, you can achieve it. I would always have these affirmations in front of me, and I still do to this day, as you know. We talk about it all the time. My dad turned me on to Earl Nightingale, who, again, was like the godfather of motivational speakers. You know, Napoleon Hill actually would be the godfather and Earl Nightingale after him. And, you know, listening to these authors and these speakers talk about the concept of humility and the concept of self-awareness and the concept of if you can dream it, then you can achieve it. You know, if you can dream it and then believe it, then you can achieve it. That concept, from an early age, I knew that, yeah, this was true and I can do it. And then when I started doing a couple little seminars and clinics and speaking engagements through various gigs and stuff, I knew that I had the tenacity to stand before an audience and just, you know, talk about this stuff and not feel anxiety or get, you know, the jitters, but I can actually do it. And because I knew I lived it. If you live it, I think you can talk it, you know.
If you speak what you know.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the crux of the matter here.
You can walk, you can talk.
Yeah, exactly. Everything I teach on the Career Musician, I've been through. You know, so when people hit me up on the webinar and say, well, what about, I'm trying to break into this clique. I say, ah, wow, musicians and cliques. Boy, do musicians love cliques. And I hate cliques, but that's just part of the biz. And
you can't, you know. Trusted source.
Yeah, and it's you're right. It's a double-edged sword because you need the clique to have that trusted source. But then again, the clique is so difficult because it prevents from new people coming in. Right. So, you know, again, if you live through it, you can really speak on it. And that I just over the years have developed that muscle. And, you know, today people like Gary Vee or Brendan Burchard or, you know, even like back in the day, Les Brown. I love Les Brown. And like I said, Earl Nightingale and now Tom Bilyeu and, you know, whomever it may be, The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, even though he's not a
Joe Rogan,
even though they're not necessarily motivational speakers, they still ascribe to these, these principles.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can
see that. Yeah. So, you know, where do you draw your inspiration from?
Good question. I draw it from the muse, directly, vertically connected. And usually when does the muse hit me? Between 1 and 4 a.m. So therefore, I never sleep.
All right. So, what makes for a good session?
Chemistry. Wow. Chemistry. When everybody walks in the room and has good chemistry, how do you attest to good chemistry? Leave your ego at the door. Don't be a fucking asshole. And if you're a fucking asshole, don't come in.
You can feel it, right? It's
don't come in. If you think you're the shit, don't come in. If you have an attitude, decompress. Release that attitude before you enter the room. If you had a bad day, you know, decompress before you come in the room. Don't have the ego, the God complex. That's what makes for a good session. When everybody is humble and just has that chemistry connects.
Same question for tour.
Same thing. Identical. Listen, on a tour, you're living together on a damn tour bus. You're sleeping together within close proximity of these bunks on a tour bus or even in a hotel. You know, a lot of times I would say to the tour manager, please don't put me on the same level as all of the other people in the hotel, because I need a space where if the whole band and crew are on, you know, floor 8 at the hotel, then please put me on floor 7 or floor 5 or floor 10. Why? And a lot of people would think I was being an asshole. No. I just need to disconnect. I just need to have my alone time so that when I am with you guys, I'm not an asshole. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that I can really say, oh man, I love being with my crew, my tour family. And I just needed that disconnect sometimes. We all need privacy. So I think that's a key factor in what you're saying.
So speaking of tour, do you have a crazy moment that stands out while being on tour? I mean, I'm sure there's so many.
Oh, crazy moments.
I don't want to hear top 5. I don't want to hear about groupies.
And it's my wife asking me, so what am I going to say? Yeah.
This is not a podcast anymore. This is a full-on
this is a trap.
Interrogation.
Yeah, right.
This whole hour has been leading up to this moment right here.
Oh, man. You know,
I'll
tell this story, yeah, because after this, Nomad will be dead. his 100th and last episode. I told you this story. When I went to Russia, we were guided into this little speakeasy, and we had to go through this curtain, and you see these two hot Russian babes sitting at the desk, and you're thinking, oh yeah, and they're gonna take your name, right? They're gonna take your name, they sign you in, but then you see these two huge Russian dudes, like built like freaking Ivan Drago from Rocky 3, right? And they have these guns, and the guns are visible. You can see the gun right here. It's not like they're hiding the gun. And they're like, and they open the curtain, and you go into the elevator, and you go down, and you're like, oh shit. And we're, you know, a group of probably 6, 7, 8 guys, 9 guys, whatever. And then they open another curtain, and when you open it, you just see the speakeasy, and you see like another, you know, 13, 15 hot Russian girls holding the trays with drinks and walking around these little short skirts and stuff. And you're in a speakeasy. Like they transported you back to like, you know, 1920 speakeasy. Okay. And all these old Russian oligarchs, you know, gambling. And you're like, I shouldn't be seeing this. I shouldn't be seeing this. I think this is illegal. I think this is illegal. Oh my God. If my girlfriend knew back home, because we were just boyfriend and girlfriend, she would kill me. You know, I'm like, I can't look. Oh my God, I can't look. You know, that kind of thing. and then they escort you into the back room, and it's this nice little quiet, you know, restaurant with a really long table and a little stage in the back. We were performing on the little stage, and this was our first night there, so we had the night off. And then Robert, our liaison, says, okay, please have a seat, you know? And he says, please tell the ladies what you would like to eat. And all these ladies come around, they say, you know, to take your order. And they have a blank pad. They don't give you a menu, but they have a blank pad and a little pen. What would you like to eat? Can I see a menu? Oh, no, you tell us what you like and we'll make it for you. What? Chicken, potatoes, vegetables, steak. I would love a filet mignon. I would love this and that. And like, okay. And they brought it all out to you. Exactly what you said. I would like pasta with shrimp and fettuccine and this and that. And they, whatever you said, that's what they brought to you. But before they brought it to you, guess what they brought first? Giant bottles of vodka. Giant clear bottles of vodka fresh from the freezer with the ice dripping off of it. And Robert would stand up and say, okay, toast to my American friends and welcome, we welcome you to Russia. And we were on tour with Babyface, and we are so grateful to have Babyface here perform for us and your whole entire team, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then they would pour, and their shot glasses were like this big, you know. And then you
like a
shot glass was this, you know, you take the shot and you're like, you know, me and Richie Pena, my buddy, the drummer, and Kevin Wyatt, the bass player, and Brandon Coleman, who's now with Kamasi Washington and doing his own thing. And we were all like, okay. Yeah. We take a shot and we're like, whoa. And then they pour another round. We're like, take another shot. We just got off the plane and got to the hotel, and it's probably like freaking 10 o'clock at night, you know? And then he says, and Robert pulls everybody and says, okay, I'm so glad you're here. Now listen to me. You can eat all the food you want. You can drink all the vodka you want, but don't touch our women.
I agree with that, Russian.
I feel like if I was in that situation and I was told that, like, my intention would have never been to touch them in the first place. Right. But now that you've said it, now I'm like, don't touch
like,
them.
It made you think, like, you can't even look at them. Like,
it's just another thing to, like, oh, my God. What the pressure.
And I'm telling you, Richie and Brandon can attest to this.
So that's...
Hold on. I got to say.
And we were just brand new. We had just met.
As somebody who has either listened to or worked on all 100 episodes of this podcast...
Yeah.
We've had some great freaking stories. Yeah. Like, what's your most ridiculous tour moment? That is the greatest story I've heard on this podcast. Oh, my God.
And now that you've said that, I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't mention, like, what I thought he was going to tell you.
Oh no, you have access to the vault.
There's another Russian story.
Oh my God.
The band had just, I think you went to Japan too?
Yeah. I don't know if we went on that same run. Yeah.
You had just come from somewhere, and a fan had given the whole band watches.
Oh, that's right.
And everybody got like a neon color watch, a yellow one, an orange one, whatever. Everybody got the same watch, just a different color. And the Russian that they're working with here, is there like a pedal that you have, like a guitar pedal handy? Do you have one that you can hand me?
No, I can't.
Hand me that box of picks there.
Okay.
So basically, basically the Russian's talking to him with like a watch on
his hand. It was ginormous.
And it was fine.
It was a clock?
Giant box. Yeah. It was like a grandfather clock on this motherfucker's arm, right? But that was fine because his arm was like, you know, the size of, you know, a horse's ass. I mean that in a nice way. Please don't come and kill us. Anyway.
Oh, no, man.
So Nomad's like, man, you know, like just staring at his watch because it's like blinding him. Yeah. And so the Russian's like, nice watch. You have a nice watch too.
And I had a little puny American watch. You know,
he's like,
and he asked me to take it off.
He's like, take it off.
And I'm like,
and he's like, what? No. He's like, duh, take it off. And he's like, yeah, he takes it. And he goes, takes off his wallet. He goes, here.
And I'm like, no.
And Nomad's like,
No, I don't want this watch.
This is your watch.
No, please, I can never do that. No.
This is my watch.
And he's
like,
my God, dude.
And so, like, now we have, like, this watch that literally would, like, put him under the ocean if he wore it.
It weighs, like, 38 pounds.
He'd be sleeping with the fishies if he put this thing on. It's huge. And that's how the Russians are. They are so generous. And so, like, if you comment on something, they will take the jacket off their back and be like, that you take. They are so kind. Like, I mean... It's amazing. You had a really good story.
You guys are like blowing my mind with these stories, right?
Well, I can't believe I haven't heard this yet.
Oh my God.
Stories with Nomad and Lola.
See what you guys are getting exclusive on the Career Musician podcast.
That's right. See?
Damn.
When was your pinch yourself moment? You had to have had several, but what was like one where you were like, holy shit, how
do I hear? When, okay, now you're going to make me pull out a pick here. When we're on stage at the Barbados Jazz Festival, and, you know, Stevie Wonder...
You're playing that. On stage in Barbados.
Stevie Wonder singing us. We're on stage. Ricky Minor's the MD, and we got Teddy Campbell on drums. We got, you know, Dave DeLome on keys. We got all these cats. I think Phelan Gaines was there. I mean, everybody was there. We're playing, right? And it was, I'm like, yeah, oh, I'm living it, man. I'm like 32 or whatever. Yeah, I'm living it. And he go, and Stevie Wonder, right over to stage left, he goes, guitar player, E flat. I'm like, oh shit, I was playing it in the wrong key.
Oh no, and he's yelling at you.
That was a pinch myself moment where I said, wow, you're a fucking idiot.
You, not Stevie
me.
Wonder.
No, me, myself, talking to myself like, I'm an idiot. Now, actually, it was the reverse. The record, Stevie Wonder's original record was an E-flat.
E-flat, yeah.
And what they did, because most guitar players, you don't play an E-flat because it's to an E, they had put it up to E. So that all the guitars, you don't have to retune the guitars. That would be a hassle. And Stevie was like, no, E, you know. So I was playing it in E. Anyway, I was playing it in the wrong key because I was playing the record key, but I didn't know that they changed the key for live performance. Why? Because I got cocky and I wasn't reading the chart. I was like, I don't need to read the chart. I know this song. Why read the chart? I know this song. I've been playing this song since I'm 15. I don't need to read the chart.
Ah, so a lesson to a young grasshopper.
That was a pinch myself moment, you dumbass. Read the chart.
Well, you know, it's still a good moment.
Oh, and by the way, Sting was stage left watching. Oh, and Patti LaBelle and Natalie Cole.
So yeah. They all watched your spot.
Yeah, they all watched me screw up.
But that's okay. They all worked with you again. Yeah, yeah. Sure.
Exactly.
All right, so what would you say to a struggling musician? What advice would you give them?
My dad would always tell me, God rest his soul, I love him. He was my first and only hero. Art and commerce don't mix. So if you want to be an artist, resolve to the fact that you're not going to be able to monetize it. If you want to be wealthy, become a business person and keep your artistry relegated to nothing but a hobby. I've been able to do both, thankfully, gratefully, knock wood, thank God, but it's not easy. Have this conversation with yourself. If you have a spouse or a significant other, have this conversation with them or your family and be 1,000,000% transparent and honest with yourself and them. If this is really something you want to do, and you feel you're called to do it, then you have to do it. But you can't half-ass it. You have to go all in. 150,000%. And if you're not willing to die for it, then it's not for you.
So what, you know, it's a labor of love, obviously. You've been dedicated to, you know, not just the career of being a musician. You know, you have to be completely dedicated to the music and the muse. When it calls, you answer.
You answer.
When anybody calls, you answer.
You answer.
What keeps you going all the long hours?
When I get to come into my little studio, my little project studio here in Burbank, and just create, and I get so excited that I don't come into the house until 6 a.m. and say, "Lo, I just made the most amazing track, and I can't wait for you to sing on it."
Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, I'm usually at the root of that. Yeah.
You know, that's what keeps me going. When we hear a track and we're like, oh, wow, this is going to be our next single. And people laugh because single, who are you? Nobody knows you. Yeah, I don't give a shit. Nobody knows me. We're still going to release it as a single on all the music aggregator platforms because we believe in it. Well, and whether we're as famous as the Black Keys or Alicia Keys or Nomad and Lola or nobody, we don't give a fuck because it's true to us.
Right. Well, right? I have a fun story. I'm going to just jump in there. You know, you don't, like most people, don't really take the small victories like they should. And I walked into the Hobby Lobby the other day. And I shit you not, your song was playing on the loudspeaker at Hobby Lobby. And this girl right here threw down in the aisle.
Yeah.
I was dancing, totally embarrassing our daughter, filming it. Anybody who walked by and looked at me, I was like, this is my husband's song.
In the Hobby Lobby.
It
was this song, by the way. It was...
Give Thanks. Yeah. Off which album?
Discovery New.
That's a whole different album we didn't even discover on this interview. But stay tuned for episode 101.
Kirk Whalen, Kirk Whalen produced that album for me.
The point is, you know, maybe somebody, you know, sure, nobody knew who that was except for me.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't matter.
Oh, my only fan. Thank you.
You're still making a living and you're still making an impact.
That's right.
It made my shopping experience much better.
You're right, because you filmed it and sent it to me. I was like, yay.
But anyway, all right. So, you know, you have a passion for music advocacy, you know, teaching musicians their rights and giving them, you know, a foundation in which they can jump off of, you know, really, because it's a blind jump and it's up to
them on
how they're going to fall.
That's right.
Because it's either flying is, right? You're just falling. or how they're going to roll with it.
Right.
But, you know, you have such a passion for it. What's next for the career musician?
What's next for the career musician is a full-fledged education course that says, look, you know what? Are you not sure? You want to be a professional musician, but you're not sure where to start or how to get the ball rolling? Check this out. I'm going to walk you through step by step, and I'm going to have a delineated course on each segment of the industry. Session work, touring work, writing as a songwriter or artist, producing other artists, composing for TV and film. You know, the educational department. I'm going to walk you through each course step by step and say, hey, this is where you can get started. This is how you can perpetuate movement and awareness in each of these arenas. And I believe this is how you can excel in these areas because I've done it. And if I can do it, so can you. I'm just a regular Joe born on Strong Island, New York.
Oh my God.
You know, Strong Island. You know,
Wow.
Suffolk County. So you know, but if I can do it from Strong Island, Long Island, you know, look, you can do it. I don't care where you're from. It's so funny. I do that. But a lot of people tease me. I'm a New Yorker. Shut up! Don't you ever say because I wasn't born in the city. I'm the freaking New Yorker. Long Island is New York, okay? But anyway, no, my whole point is if I can do it, and I was just, you know, my dad was an immigrant from Cuba, and my mom was like a third generation, you know, Italian, and they met when they were very young, and they were so inexperienced, and they made it work, and then they had us kids. I'm the eldest of three boys, so I have two younger brothers whom I love dearly, Jason and Robbie, you know, who both live in South Florida, and they have their own businesses as tattoo artists, and they're thriving. Our parents taught us how to be self-sufficient, and they taught us the essence of grit. Now, back then, nobody called it grit. Today, we call it grit, but, you know, it was grinding. It was hustling. It was figuring it out. It was working, and it was, you know, we talked about it with the fellas earlier, the autonomy of being self-employed, an independent contractor. I don't care who you are, what walk of life you come from, or what arena you find yourself in, the autonomy of being an independent contractor is invaluable. And it's a level playing field. If Kevin Hart can do it, if Will Smith can do it, if what's his name from Tesla? Elon Musk can do it. If, you know, whomever you look up to, if they can do it, guess what? So can you. And I'm not trying to be cheesy. I mean that wholeheartedly.
That's a beautiful message. It's a great message. And I stand with the career musician.
Oh,
and
thank
his
you.
Message.
Now, I stand with the career musician.
Charlie? Yes.
I also stand with the career musician.
I sit with the career musician.
what time are we at?
Like a four and a half hour episode.
So let's wrap this up with our last.
It's tomorrow.
It's tomorrow.
okay, no, we're at 1:20 right now. So, yeah. If we're going to do the rapid fire, let's get the timer.
I just want to make sure Pro Tools is still going.
Yeah, man, this is all self-produced.
That's Guerrilla
right. Pro Tools right here.
Yay, still going. We have, one camera, two camera, three.
I think we have like four.
We have four cameras,
iPad over here. Everything's going. All right.
All right, what you got for me, Lo? And Eric G.
First of all, this was a
really, C-Money.
This was a really fun interview. Thank you for... Yes. For
thank you. I'm elated.
Invade your podcast.
Of course.
And you have some amazing stories, so it was about time that your audience got to hear a little bit about you.
Thank you.
I'm really excited about the career musician, the future of what it's going to bring to musicians all around the world. I think that's really important because we've been taken advantage of, and the stereotype of us being drug addict losers is, I'm done with that.
It's a bunch of bull. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
It's stupid.
Yeah.
So, all right. I just wanted to say thank you for letting us be here. It was an honor interviewing you.
Thank you,
guys. Enjoyed listening, and now we're going to do this rapid fire. Let's go.
Am I relegated to the 1 minute?
Yes, you are.
I get 3 minutes at least?
Follows protocol. Dude. That's my main job. You know what?
Whatever.
Whatever.
You got 1 minute on the clock.
Everybody always says how much they love my sticker guitar, so I'm going to
You have 59 seconds on the clock.
You can't hide behind your guitar.
I'm holding my sticker guitar.
You have 56 seconds on the
clock. What do they call the pets?
Oh, you familiar?
Emotional animals. Is your emotional support?
Yes. This is my emotional support, yes.
I said familiar. That's like...
Yeah, all right.
So we're doing 1 minute?
1 minute.
Okay, here we go.
Jeez.
All right, I know we're very excited.
Cheese and crackers.
I hope you're excited at home.
Okay, all right.
All right, Eric, count me in.
All right.
Oh, wait, are you going to count how many he gets to?
No, we do that in post.
Okay. Really?
Yeah,
okay.
We do that in post.
Okay, sorry.
Fix it in post.
Which is code for we'll never do it. All right, let's go.
In 3, 2, 1, go.
Favorite city?
In New York.
What entertains you?
Good music.
Studio or live?
Both.
Top three artists?
Eddie Van Halen, Paco de Lucia, George Benson.
Hidden talents?
I can cook really well.
Shopping online or in store? I know this.
Both.
Yeah, telephone especially. Dream collaboration?
Paco de Lucia.
Introvert or extrovert?
Both.
Guilty pleasure?
Whiskey.
What would you do if you weren't a career musician?
Architect.
Electric or acoustic?
Both.
Song or band that changed your life?
All of them.
No.
Van Halen.
Decade of music?
The 60s.
Which is your social media accounts that gets the most attention?
Instagram, but it sucks still.
Name your top three tour essentials.
Guitar, laptop, phone.
Four. Driver or passenger? Three.
Passenger.
Two.
Restaurant.
One.
Italian food. Cuban food. Man, that's exhausting. Holy cow.
It's your heart racing. Right?
You guys, my favorite restaurant. It's like, I mean, I love Italian food. I love Cuban food. I love Thai food.
I'm surprised you didn't say the Cuban sandwich.
The Cuban sandwich, my dad's restaurant.
Don't worry. It's okay. That's not your favorite. I mean.
Well, it is. It was. Oh, yeah. I could eat at my dad's restaurant every day when it was happening.
Hey, man. Right. Well, hey, if you're craving a good Cuban sandwich, Mambo's in Burbank.
They're not sponsoring this shit. But I love you, Mambo's.
It doesn't matter. We're helping the community.
That's right. El Criollo.
El
Criollo.
Yeah, I'm a gringa. All right. Thanks for tuning in. It's our 100th episode. It's New Year's Eve. Let's count down. What the fuck? Why not?
What are we counting down?
To the new year. To get over to 2020.
Hold on. Can I plug in?
Are we going to do
I can do this.
All Lang Syne?
Well, I don't know. But I can do this.
Eric's like, what is that?
No,
alright, ready? Are you ready? We can time
one,
two, now, one. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Hurry! 3, 2, 1.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.